beautiful. I feel like I'm full of cigarette smoke right now. It's just so evocative.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. In the best way.
Great big crashing poem.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute.
Not blubbering baby stuff.
We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race.
Like Oprah said, the road less traveled.
You know, that doesn't mean what everybody thinks about.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
And if you like it, I mean, if you like my poem, and if you feel it adds something to your life in any way, then you can pay me whatever you feel like.
Oh, shit, we about to get educated.
Hey, this is another installment of Pardon My Poem, and I am talking to an old poetry friend of mine, Jerry Terrio. I'm so happy to reconnect with her in this conversation. We could have talked forever. We're talking about her book, Self-Portrait as Homestead, from Deerbrook Editions. We love Deerbrook. And if you want to reconnect with poetry or read lively language-driven poems that are emotional and real and with exquisite craft, hey, pick up Homestead by Jerry Terrio. It's a really beautiful book. It's got her art on the cover, so you can't miss it, and she's an artist as well. She has a show currently in Yarmouth at the Yarmouth History Center until November 2nd. So really great thing to check out. Jerry is Franco-American poet. She went to Colby. She also went to Vermont College of Fine Arts. And she's been a teacher. She has some wonderful credits to her name. She's also the 2023 Maine Arts Commission Literary Arts Fellow, among a lot of really wonderful laurels, too. So I want you to hear this conversation about her book, Homestead. This is Jerry Terrio.
I mentioned, too, in my question about, you know, what about this? This sounds like somebody that's kind of found her voice. I mean, we're older poets. God help us if we haven't found our voice. But it just has this kind of confidence and calm where it's like, yeah, this poet has really, you know, there's a consistency in the lines and the lengths of the poem. And you just kind of go into it where this person is really holding you in this world.
I think the confidence piece, for sure. I've been writing all my life, and I think that in itself helps to inspire confidence. But also the fact that the subjects of these poems are my family, my hometown, my history. Some of it is made up, but it's all stuff that's very, very important to me. So I think that those things together, the fact that I'm older, the fact that I've been doing this a long time, but the fact that I'm writing about these things that are so very important to me, really give a sense of competence or confidence.
Narrative poetry collection. And I was thinking about that, what that really means. You know, it's like these events that occur in linear time. You know, they're sort of the writing of the poem itself complicates the chronology or complicates the significance of the event and so it sort of heightens the events that they're talking about by whatever frame the poet's putting around it. I mean, I'm just saying what narrative poetry is really, but I was just thinking, like, that's just the essence of this book, you know, like it is the quintessential kind of narrative poetry collection, which does that in such a beautiful way, which we can talk about how, you know, that is achieved and all, but.
Yeah, it started out as a book about feminine experience. So the part that has been there all along is the girl, mother, grandmother, elder, you know, the sort of progression of the female roles in life that I have experienced, but also allowing my mother, my grandmother, my aunts, you know, these other, my sister, my cousins, in as well, all of these women. That was there from a pretty early stage. But it was only when I decided or thought of the idea of place, and somebody actually suggested this to me, somebody who read the manuscript said, you know, it would help to have some organizing elements in this book. And that's when I thought of the addresses as a way of anchoring the book. It's also when I thought of, you know, I mentioned the cousins. Well, the cousins had peripheral roles in here, and I decided that they were sort of a Greek chorus. These cousins, and that, I think there are only three or four poems where the cousins are, but it's really a touchstone for me to have those cousins there. And so once I started doing that, then I came up with the title. I can't remember if I wrote the title poem first or I thought of it for the title of the book, Self-Portrait as Homestead. Once I did that, everything sort of clicked into place because I had myself not only as member of this, of these generations, of this family, of these women, but also myself as house. You know, that kind of melding of the place and the self.
Yep.
And it gave me permission to write some other poems with addresses as the titles, and you know, and it led to my writing in the voices of my father and writing in the voice of my grandmother, and I had not done before. So
that's interesting that you're saying that perhaps the title poem came early on, because it's so so interesting how now it's placed near the end. It's kind of this culmination of these, a lot of physical geography, like you're saying, and that becomes much more metaphorical. Kind of all sort of comes together. So that's interesting that it's almost like a working backwards in the creation.
I can't remember the exact chronology. I can't remember, for example, I think the poem Ode to My Father's Body, which is the first poem, I think I had written that before, but that also falls into that category of, you know, I'm walking through the hallway of my father's, hallways of my father's body. My father is also a house where I lived, you know? And so that, we keep coming back to that notion of we live in a place. We live in a place. We are, our bodies exist in a place, and the places help to reveal, I don't know, conflict, character, life was.
And
The women worked in the Hathaway, which was the woolen mill. Was the Hathaway woolen? They made shirts there. They made shirts there, so it wasn't woolen. And the men usually worked in the paper mill, which is across the room. But I know that in the Hathaway where the women worked, there was no air conditioning. And the temperature would just, it almost unbearable, you know, in those rooms. And Matt, somebody had an exhibit up there in Waterville back a few years ago about that mill and the women's work and their own words, the women's memories, you know, written down. And one woman had written that she wasn't a smoker, but she took up smoking because if you smoked, you would get an extra break in the afternoon to go smoke.
Sure.
Yeah, here's another point. This poem was originally called Hard Breathing. But when I changed, you know, when I changed the sort of focus and the name of the book, I thought, oh no, Homestead, this is a better title. So, okay, Homestead. You walk the ends and starts of June, breathe lilacs and salt marsh, car spewed toxins. Last year's rumor of heat. Somewhere, factories unmake still lungs, backs, hands, like those boom time pulp and loom, hard breathing jobs your ancestors glad for good sweat and strain, inhaled dirt and weed killer, breathed smokestack and cigarettes. Work paid mortgage, happy for overtime, split shift, side by side, father, son, steady paycheck, girl, your aunt, in the back room, breathed cotton lint, 2 decades. All of the makers of their own lives, like Renaissance painters, breathing, tasting, paint, the whitest of whites, everlasting, clabbered white, chipped, sweet-smelling lead, breathed pot roses and lavender, cut grass and clover, inhaled after shift laughs and stories, exhaled brothers, father, your aunt with the excised lung in the too small paid for house, everything earned with the work of dangerous breathing. Even now, somewhere, a grandfather and uncles inhale tomato vines, watered scent rising, play cribbage in the cool, moth soft dusk, breathe easy. What you've always breathed, grief and goodness, alveoli and folding detritus and duff in delicate plackets, pit scarring like the wind-burned faces of far-gazing pioneers. You know, one of the questions you sent me was about the emotional impact of the poems without meditation from the poet.
Mm.
I'm glad you asked that because what I was trying to do was to put the reader in the middle of the experience rather than explaining
or
giving my thoughts about it.
Yes, yes.
And so,
that's what I noticed right away and wanted to know. How did she do it? How am I feeling this?
Yeah.
I'm not even really sure without just taking it line by line, but.
Well, I think it came bit by bit. You know, it took me several years to write this book and it came bit by bit. And, you know, if you look at the beginnings of the poems, they all begin in medias res. You know, this one I just read, you walk the ends and starts of June, breathe life. I mean, there's no exposition there. There's no buildup. In the first poem, I always love the way that one begins. It's, I lose my way in the low note harmonica of my father's absence.
Pull the map so nice.
Body. I mean, there you are, and you're unfolding this map.
Mm. Yeah.
Which feels like that's what you're doing, even though it's of his body.
Yeah.
So all of these are in the middle of things.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that all the rough drafts didn't start that way.
Yeah.
I kept moving in that direction because I wanted them to be. And certainly by the time I thought, I want households in this poem. I want people in these poems, you know?
Yeah.
So Willie and Ikey and Ray, serious and laughing, work at the paper mill. I mean, there you are. You're not, you know, you're not thinking about it. You're there. And so I'm so glad to hear that works for you.
Mm.
You see it, you know, because.
Sure. Yeah.
I was hoping.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting that there may have been some, I mean, there was clearly consciousness of that. And as a result, some taking away. To really achieve it.
I also have been known, you know, we know our weaknesses, right? At this stage, our weaknesses. And my weakness has always been to pretty something up so much that something's hidden. And I think because when I was a little girl, when I was young, I wanted to make beautiful language. I didn't want to share my sorrows. I didn't want to share the ugly stuff. I wanted to share the beauty. And so I would hide things.
Yes.
But I really developed the ear and the music of the words. So I think now that I'm older, that ability is serving me because I know enough to put some real emotion. I can't just hide. I have to be real. I have to talk about walking through those hallways of my father's body, trying to find him. I have to, you know, I can't just make it pretty. So
that's, I've said this probably on this very podcast. That's the story of my poetry life, you know, just, I don't have to be responsible for this, if it's wrong or if it's stupid or if it's risky, yeah. Because, you know, it's a metaphor and it can mean 18 different things. So, you know, don't have to, you know, blame me for it. But yeah, eventually you have to, like, no, you gotta kind of stand behind the thing.
Yeah.
That you're saying, yeah, that changed everything for me writing. Right. For sure, that's neat to hear that you felt that too. But well, also,
it helps that they're all dead now. My parents are, you know, my grandparents are dead.
Yes. So
especially my mother, whom I was much closer to. I couldn't write about her very much when she was alive.
Sure.
I just couldn't.
It's risky. Hard. Yeah, it is really hard. Yeah. And also that sense that you have with language and, you know, and lyric and all of that, you know, it's great that, you know, we can have that in our toolbox and kind of yank it out sparingly when it really works and then and just, you know, and then go along. It's the kind of the perfect recipe.
And see those moments where, oh no, you got too much here, honey. Let's put that away because you don't need all that.
Yeah. Yeah. So easy.
And I can see that in my own work now, you know, so that's a very helpful thing.
Right.
Yeah. The other piece is invention. There's a lot of invention in this book. And
Tell me more.
Yeah, the reason being, you know, I've got a poem about my grandmother in my grandmother's voice. Well, it's based on what I knew of her. She had 7 kids. She must have been working all the time around the clock, right? 7 kids, and they lived on a farm. Mm. And she must have been just always working. So I tried to put it in her voice.
Yeah.
And I made it up. So there's one. And then my father, the poems that are in my father's voice, again, he didn't tell me these stories. He didn't tell me. He didn't really speak very much. He was a very silent man. And so I went looking for him and invented him. And I always say this at my readings when I read those poems, that invent comes from the Latin invenio, which means to find. So we always think of invent as making up, but it's finding.
And it was there.
Yeah.
It wasn't not there. Yeah.
Right. Or at least in this case, yes, these are invented specifics, but you're finding your father here. You're finding your grandmother who died when you were young, or, you know, and that's a sense of some of these poems that. Finding them.
Yeah, I didn't know whether to dwell in this or not. Those poems don't overwhelm the collection, so I don't know. But I am very interested in that and did want to ask you a little more about it in terms of how you set out to, you know, what the rules were for you. What's the boundary? Is it going to be what this person would say? How much is me? How much is, what line don't I cross?
Well, I think the big thing was giving myself permission to do it.
Mm.
And as I said, with my grandmother, you know, I knew she had all these kids. She, for a while anyway, they lived on a farm. Her life, I'm sure, was work. And taking that, and she was very handy. She was always making things. And she was a good cook. And so using those scant facts, I created this narrative, right? And with my father, I know that he was artistic. He had a beautiful baritone voice.
Mm.
And we have some drawings of his when I think he was a teenager before he went to war. He did all these drawings. One is a self-portrait. So I knew he liked to draw or could draw. So there's one poem that is about him when he was 9, in his voice, when he's 9, drawing on the wall.
Yeah.
Moving the dresser to hide it, you know. I just
so is that a thing that you are speculating he may or may not have done? Yes.
Totally speculating about that. He was one.
That wasn't a thing he told.
He was one of 12 kids.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah.
When he was 9, he had a brother 9 years older, and a brother infant. So he, you know, and they all lived in that house, which was, I think, a 3-bedroom house. So his older brothers who are coming in from the mill, and they sleep in the same bedroom, they're coming in, and he's drawing on the wall, and he stole the crayon or whatever it was from school to draw on the wall. And so I'm creating that little boy. And you know, I love that little boy. Yeah, I created him, and I think it's sort of what we all, when we get older, we always do with our parents. We are able to look at them, however flawed they were, and understand them and love them, rather than thinking, why wasn't he a better this or that, or why didn't he talk to me, or what, you know. So that's the gift of these poems to me, that they, I'm creating him in a very sympathetic light. Same with the one, the Iwo Jima poem.
Yes.
Which was so hard to write. I couldn't write it. And finally, I remembered there was an article in the paper. It was an interview with him on the 50th anniversary of Iwo Jima. And God bless the Maine State librarians. I got in touch with them, got a copy of this article. Once I had that, I could splice the reporter's words, father's answers into the poem. And it wasn't just me writing about him and imagining. It was him talking about that experience. I could smell the rotting flesh. You know, I get goosebumps even now. And every time I read that poem at a reading, I'm almost overcome because he was 19 years old. And he went through that. You know, he wore the same clothes for 30 days. So, my daughter-in-law also said, I don't know if I like it, if you're making this stuff up. And what I explained is, you know, the emotional truth. I was going for the emotional truth rather than all of the facts happened exactly this way, as any writer would do, right? I mean, you don't, even in a memoir, you choose what you put in and what you leave out, and you change the names of the characters to protect, you know, you do things.
Look at 13. Do you want to tell me about that poem?
13, yeah.
I love that poem.
And this is one of the spare ones, right? It's I think of it as almost a gesture drawing, you know, because it takes place in a house, or at least partly. And it's one of the girl poems.
Yes.
You know, there's a section in the book that's the girls. And those were very early poems in this whole thing.
Sure.
Because I wanted to write about that experience. You know, I have a granddaughter who's just turned 21.
Oh, wow. Jerry, old, aren't we?
Wow. But anyway, so she, you know, I think of her, and of course my own daughter as well, and what being a girl is. And so that's where this poem came from. And of course, in maybe not all of them, but a lot of the poems about the girls, their nuns are involved as well. 13. We cracked bazooka gum, rolled our plaid skirt short, and ignored the nuns we called mothers back then, who prayed hard for us and remembered, too fat, too thin, too pretty, too plain, almost drunk with wanting, bought skimpy dresses with birthday money and danced dirty in Annie's cellar playroom. Bodies like ponies, all leg and mane, prancing, awkward. Our mothers at the top of the stairs breathed it all, cool grass and sweat, long nights running before they were broken.
Girls are so lively and so vivid. In this book, I'm also thinking of girlhood Revised. I love that poem as well.
I was going to say that Girlhood Revised is one of my favorite titles in this collection because it allows the reader to think, she made this up.
Sure. Some liberty was taken here. Yeah. We don't know. There's a lot of unsaid probably here. And in a lot of these poems, with the father, there's a lot of unsaid things. I'm thinking of also the, is it Single Wide of your mother's? There's a wonderful line of things just that aren't, where it says, and for the longest time, you wouldn't consider what brought her here, wouldn't let yourself hear what she didn't say when she said she was rehearsing for her coffin like your father. It's kind of like, okay, you wouldn't hear, let yourself hear what she didn't say. And there's so much sort of not being said there too.
That's not a poem that I could have written when my mother was alive or, she really did literally say she was rehearsing for her coffin when she lived in the trailer. And she said it kind of like, haha. But it's not something I wanted to examine back then.
No.
I didn't want to examine.
So what she wasn't saying was the non-joke sentence of that sentence.
Right. I mean, she said it sort of as a joke, but I think there was also some seriousness there as well. Because we think of those things when we're older. But how can you know when you're in your 30s or... You can't.
Right. Right. It is just a joke, sort of. It doesn't penetrate.
Now that I'm older, I know what it felt like to her to be there. And what I'm saying is, nice place for her. She's got a little deck and she can hear the river and she can play solitaire. Mm. How nice for her.
Mm. And she's like, look at the dimensions of this. Yeah. A little weird. Stephen Dunn, he has this poem about the things around the house. I think it's called how his mother, he wanted to see her breasts or something as a little tiny kid. And she opened up her shirt and she was like, there you go. Take a good hard look, and then buttoned her shirt back up and started doing the regular things around the house or something. And I remember him saying, it's a great poem too. I mean, he should have published it like too sweet because it was so beautiful, but he had to wait before his mother died to be able to publish it.
I think that's part of the burden of being a writer, especially a poet, that you write about all this stuff, and you own it. But I started making art in about 2007, I was in a really bleak period of writing. I couldn't write. And I was living in Prague at the time. And I started making visual art. I started collaging and drawing. Hmm. I couldn't draw worth beans, but I was drawing everywhere, all the time. And then when I came home, I took a couple of drawing classes at Mecca. And a teacher that I had, I don't know if you know Martha Miller. She taught it at Mecca for a while, and she would have life drawing and portraiture. Those are the two classes that she taught, and she always had a session on collage. And so during those classes, I actually did portraits of people with collage, because Martha said do it, and I did it, and I really loved it. And so from that time, I was always making collage and drawing, but I had no purpose or focus. And then during the pandemic, I was trying to do a collage a day and all that. And then finally, I got invited for this show that I have, and based on the art I had already produced, so that's good. But I said, what am I going to do for this show? It's true, I have some art, but there's no theme. There's nothing, to tie it together. I don't think it's good enough. So last spring, I decided I was going to take the patchwork quilt as my theme. And then I went to the Louise Nevelson show at Colby. And you work is so grids, right? And that kind of strengthened my desire to do something with grids and that kind of pattern. And so starting about mid-June until September 3rd, when I had to turn all the art in, I made 27 pieces of art.
Wow. Unbelievable.
But I had a vision. I had, okay, patchwork quilt. I got all these books about quilts. And what I did was I was breaking the canvas down into sections. And then each section I would choose my colors. And it just made so much sense to me.
Do you want to read Communion? Just because I love that poem, and it sort of speaks to a lot of the things I think that we're talking about and have talked about, and we can end with it.
Okay. Communion. In a 1940s photo, my mother sports a beret and snug peacoat, her face unlined and marvelous. She's about to light her first cigarette, a Pall Mall or Lucky, about to ignite her need for the world by pulling it hard inside her, unleashing endless blue exhalations behind closed windows in restaurants and cars. Every adult, Dad and my uncle, school bus driver, Humphrey Bogart, even the doctor, inhaled, exhaled my childhood, but mostly my mother, with coffee, with beer, morning and night, smoke her constant halo, even after the hospital and emphysema. Smoke, such a comfort that old enough to know better and looking like her young self, I filled my dorm room with white clouds of want. Even now, I long to stand in the side yard on a wet night, breathing the stunted lift of my mother's smoke, taste her prayer-braised breath, and swallow the whole dark and ashy world.
Pardon My French is produced by Michelle Lewis. Engineering and audio production by David Brubaker at Off Road Music Studio.